You're listening to Zen Crossing, where spirituality meets everyday life, with your host, Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center.
Today we'll be talking about women, poetry, and Zen with Beata Grant. Beata Grant is professor of Chinese and religious studies in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. She's the author of several books about the poetry and lives of women Zen practitioners in China, including Eminent Nuns, Daughters of Emptiness, and Zen Echoes. Our Zen Center Spring Retreat in April at Camp South will touch upon the lives and poems of some of the women in her books. Beata, it's great to have you on the show.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much.
Tell me, how did you get interested in studying the poetry of Zen nuns in China?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll give you the short version.
Yeah, sure. I've
always been very interested in the art, religion, and culture of Asia ever since I was a child, I think. And this led me to major in what was then called Oriental Studies as an undergraduate. And then once I decided to grapple with the Chinese language, I went on to do graduate work in Chinese language and literature. And you might know poetry is the most highly regarded literary form in pre-modern China, and I love poetry anyway, so I decided to focus on poetry. Okay, but I was always very deeply interested in Buddhism as well, but at the time I didn't feel I had what it took to become a proper Buddhologist, so I decided to try to combine these interests by writing a dissertation on the Buddhist poetry of a very great 12th century poet by the name of Su Dongpo. And I really did bite off more than I could chew, given how very famous he is and how much he wrote. But it gave me a chance to learn a lot about both poetry and Buddhism. And at that time, there was very little written or known about Chinese women writers of any kind, Buddhist or otherwise. But in the 1990s, scholars began to realize that beginning in the 16th century, more or less, there was an explosion of women poets who not only wrote poetry, but had their works printed and circulated. And there were thousands of such collections, as well as several major anthologies that were compiled during this time. So it's really exciting kind of material. And over the last couple of decades, more and more scholars, mostly women scholars, have begun to delve into these materials, and it's really transformed our understanding of Chinese women and Chinese literature. And having studied mostly male poets and writers for so many years, naturally I was quite excited to learn about these women's voices that had always been there, but for the most part, pretty much ignored or overlooked.
Well, let me tell you, I'm so excited, too, as a Zen teacher. You know, all we can find in the canon, for the most part, is men's voices.
Exactly.
And so to open up this vein of women's voices, and, you know, it's a lot of poetry, but also what I really appreciate that you've done, to the extent that you can do it, is look into their lives as well and open up those. That must have taken a lot of work.
It did take a lot of work, and again, it's not easy because male poets had a lot of material written about them, official biographies and accounts and all kinds of things. But women, for the most part, did not, unless they were, well, they couldn't really become famous because they couldn't become officials or anything. Maybe they got remembered for their chastity, right?
Right.
Or their loyalty, or for committing suicide, you know, or something like that, when their husbands died, to express their loyalty. But I felt that these poems that I found, especially in Eminent Nuns, were embedded in these discourse records, which, as you know, are collections compiled by Zen masters, with records of their Dharma talks and their sermons and various kinds of things. But they also included big chunks of poetry. And partly because I just love poetry, but partly because I felt the poetry gave us a little glimpse of their more personal lives, you know, because the Dharma talks were often kind of conventional. I mean, they weren't really necessarily, you couldn't tell it was a woman speaking, right? It was just like all the Zen masters speaking, right? I mean, they were good and interesting, but not particularly insightful about their personal lives. But these poems gave a different kind of picture. And so I sort of focused on those, but then tried to embed them in the larger life, in the convent, how they became nuns, what their relationship. All the nuns that I found were all abbesses. That's why I call them eminent nuns.
Yeah.
So they had students and they had convents that they often build up and had to do a lot of fundraising, and they had to travel and give, you know, Dharma talks in various places. So I try to sort of piece together sort of their lives both before and after they became nuns, and then, of course, when they became Zen masters, officially designated Zen masters.
Let me read you something from one of the books that you've written. If the idea of men becoming monks and abandoning their familial responsibilities was never fully accepted in Confucian China, the idea of women becoming nuns was looked upon with even less favor. Beata, many of the women you write about had to go through all kinds of obstacles in order to get through the door to practice Zen. Can you talk about some of those?
As you may know, when Buddhism came to China, from the very beginning, it had to deal with the fact that for most Chinese, family and filial piety were sacred, right?
That's right.
Family values were sacred. And so Buddhism had to make a case that to become a monastic, you could acquire merit for your parents, but also for all parents in the world. In other words, it's kind of a higher form of filial piety.
Mm.
But this was a harder case for women, who were traditionally thought to only have three roles in life: the daughter, wife, and mother, defined by their relationship to father, husband, and son. And their expected domain was the inner chamber, or the world inside the home, and men, you know, could go out and become, serve the state as officials of one kind or another. And most women actually solved this dilemma by engaging in religious practice within the home. In other words, they found a way to be both good Confucian wives and mothers, but also devout Buddhist believers.
Right.
Yeah, and many of these women found Pure Land practices, you know, the single-minded recitation of the name of Amitabha Buddha,
sure,
or Amida Buddha, to be particularly suitable for this purpose, right? So that you could do it at home, and it didn't require leaving home or studying with a teacher or engaging in long meditative retreats. But Chan was different. Chan, of course, is the Chinese pronunciation for Zen. But Zen was different. The focus was on meditation, right, and working with a master and engaging in very intensive, often very difficult practice. It also required leaving home and traveling to different monasteries and having interviews with monks and various different masters. But a lot of more educated women who had a chance to read Zen literature, like the discourse records of Mazu or Linji, you know, they really wanted to pursue this. And most of them resolved the issue by first fulfilling their Confucian duties, getting married and bearing a son, and then putting off their interest until maybe their husband died. Right?
Yeah, it seemed like it. Yeah.
Yeah, and during the 17th century, it was a very unstable time, a lot of political turmoil and violence. Actually, a lot of men died very young, leaving these women widows. But, you know, because they weren't expected to get remarried, it was not considered to be a proper Confucian thing. They decided to become nuns. But then there are also other women I read about or I studied who had a very early interest in Zen and were determined to leave home without getting married at all. And sometimes the parents agreed, especially if they themselves were Buddhist devotees. But often they were strongly opposed and agreed only when their daughters threatened to do something drastic, such as, you know, commit suicide if you let me go to the nunnery or else. So there were a lot of obstacles.
I was really interested to read that there was a real opportunity also in, maybe it was around 900, I can't remember exactly the date, when one of the emperors in the Song Dynasty suspended the 8 special rules for women, which meant that nuns then could, without the help of monks, continue their own lineage. In a way, it made it a matrilineal line. Am I getting that right?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, they still studied with male masters.
Hmm.
The convents were run independently. And this is a case where Confucianism actually was a good thing, because they said men and women should be separate, right? They shouldn't be in close proximity. So the convents were run separately from those of men. So in a way, that worked well for women. So they kind of ignored the 8 special rules to a large extent.
How many collections of poetry written by nuns are there in the time periods that you've studied, would you say?
Very few. In fact, I think I've translated them all.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I wish there were more, but very, very few. I mean, there are a lot of poems sort of scattered here and there. I've collected them, a lot of them, in the Daughters of Emptiness book, in various anthologies of women's writings, but whole collections. There are just these ones within the Discourse records. And then my latest book, Zen Echoes, is kind of unique in that it's a collection of sort of poetic commentaries on Zen koans compiled by three nuns, one from the 12th century and two from the 17th, and that was circulated as an independent collection.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's very little, very little.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like the most intensive time was the 1600s in terms
of... Yeah, the 17th century. Yeah. Yes, it was. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is because there was a revival of Linji, or in Japanese, Rinzai Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked back to the Song Dynasty master Dahui Zonggao. And Dahui was one of the first Linji masters to actually name women as his officially designated Dharma heirs. So these 17th century masters, you know, they said, well, Dahui said, you know, in the great way has neither male nor female, so we had better, you know, take some female students on as well. And some of them just paid lip service to it. But others actually did take women disciples and named them their official Dharma heirs. And those women in turn took on female students and established their own sublineages.
Yeah, I was really happy to hear that, and to see that it kind of popped up again. Beata, do you have a couple of poems there at hand that you could read?
Sure. There's one by a nun by the name of Jingwo, and she entered the monastic life as a very young girl and then became the senior Dharma heir of another woman Chan master by the name of Wei Ji. And she had hundreds of followers, and she herself had a reputation for compassionate but strict discipline. Hmm. But she wrote a poem remembering her teacher, who was a woman teacher. And it's kind of rare to have that kind of expression, so I thought I would read that.
Good.
Okay. It's called Remembering Master Wei Ji. Like ice and snow, the lineage heir is an ancient one. It was stern and strict there in the quarters of the abbess. In years gone by, she personally taught and guided me. With a few words, she dispelled my blind ignorance. Her compassion in life and death matters are hard to repay, and I'm ashamed that I've not yet lived up to her teachings. I will always return to her extraordinary example for sustenance. As a model of the way, she will always be inexhaustible.
Mm. You can hear the love and appreciation.
Yeah. And then, if you want one more by her, she lived for a while in seclusion, even though she was the abbess of a big convent. Sometimes she went on personal retreat. And I like this one. It's called Living in Seclusion, Sitting in Silence. Living in seclusion, one can simply do as one pleases. With a single text, one can forget oneself for a while. The daylight hours, how much time is there really? Why then do I not exert myself? Although the ancients are long gone, their wisdom must still be grasped. From the empty eaves, water keeps on dripping. From the censer, ashes fall, marking the time. This mood always brings me great pleasure, as with both hands I clasp my book tightly. What a pity it is that ordinary people of the world know not this intimacy with the words of the wise.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Beata, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with me here.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and I'm delighted that you'll be looking at these together, these poems. I found them very inspiring to translate, and I learned a lot from them. I hope you will as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I already have, and I really want to thank you for the service that you've done, certainly the Zen community in the West.
Well, that's the least I can do.
Thanks, Beata.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Crossing. For more information about the Puget Sound Zen Center, go to pszc.org.